Hey, Lex Coach Mike here, LexCoachMike.com. Hey, just so thrilled. We had Coach Kevin Connery from University of Michigan. Quite a pedigree with this coach, obviously. Has had a couple of big, big games last year. You know, he coached under Brecht at Siena, was at Penn State, Fairfield, and then most recently as the associate head coach at Maryland, taking the Michigan job. Interesting. I found his practice plans to be a little more traditional in nature, but for good reasons, you know, and we talk about that a lot. There's some interesting stuff in this podcast about how they're monitoring heart rates and his pretty traditional parts of the hole and the way they build the entire practice. Still does his man up, man down at the end. Just some things I haven't heard in a while, but obviously they're working for him. Just thrilled to have had him on here. This is Coach Kevin Connery, University of Michigan, Lex Coach Mike, LexCoachMike.com.
Hey, Lex Coach Mike. Coach, this is my radio voice, in case you wonder what this was, right? Hey, this is Lex Coach Mike, LexCoachMike.com. For those of you that have been sending me emails, just chill, man. We finally got Coach Kevin Connery from University of Michigan. You're aware of the upsets they had last year. Coach, I try and keep these timeless, you know, so we don't talk a lot about seasons or recruiting or anything like that, but I think the program there is well on its way to great days ahead. Welcome to LexCoachMike.com.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to spending some time with you.
Yeah, don't put too much pressure on me, man, because I'm not that good. Actually, you need to have a really, really great day because you're about to carry this podcast. I hope your shoulders are feeling pretty good.
Absolutely. I'm ready.
All right, man. First question I have for you, I may not phrase it, you know, correctly. We see like a lot of young guys walking into these openings at D2, and a handful of the guys, you know, walking into some of the openings at D1. I'm really, really impressed. Just quickly, you know, reviewing the pedigree. You know, you were at Siena with Brecht, at Penn State, great program at Fairfield when you were there, and then Maryland, of course, under Tillman. So in addition to, you know, being a Hopkins guy, you've seen some interesting coaching styles in your growth getting ready to take over this prestigious D1 program, haven't you?
Absolutely. I think that's something that I think when I was a candidate for this job was impressive to the administration. And the diversity of my mentors is very is something unique and something that I truly value about how to approach not just day to day, but for a full season. And then how do you approach managing an organization? And that's really, as you kind of pull it back, when you become a head coach, you have the instructions, the skill instructions, the actual day to day of lacrosse. But realistically, it's a lot of management. It's a full managing your staff, managing your roster. So I've learned a lot over my time of how to be more effective in the management role.
I don't think our listeners, and even though I've talked about it a lot, you know, going back in time, you know, I was one of those guys 15, 20 years ago, even though we were winning, you know, that used to think that detailed practice plans were for guys that didn't understand lacrosse. And
no, I
was like the biggest idiot that ever lived, right? I mean, now my practice, we actually track touches in our practices now. You know, I mean, they're down to the minute. And I listened to, getting ready for you, I listened to a podcast that you had done maybe a year ago. You know, and the guy asked you, do you actually plan out your practices? And I heard you laughing on the podcast going, yeah, I'm pretty sure we do, man. I don't think most of our listeners or most people outside of watching lacrosse or having kids that play lacrosse or even coaching casually in lacrosse have any idea the amount of planning that goes into it. And let me follow that by saying, after all these years of podcasts, you know, 160 hours or something, Coach, I'm amazed at guys you see on the sidelines that look very animated. When you get to know them personally, you realize how analytical they actually are.
Yeah, we've become more and more analytical. And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there, but we've become more and more analytical with our practice planning because it's not just, you know, what we want to get out of practice in terms of skill development, but it's also what we're taking out of their bodies as well. So we have to go ahead and we've implemented some systems in place where we can actually track how much exertion they're putting out. So when we're sitting down and planning our practices, we actually look at, okay, how much is this going to be physically taxing to our guys? And, you know, so we don't hit a number for the full practice. We do drill by drill to say, okay, we call it player load. What is the player load on the average for the key guys here? So we don't exceed that player load for a full practice, and we manage it. So on Saturday, we feel like we're more fresh. We don't want to over-practice or overtrain. We want to make sure that our kids' legs are fresh and have a full tank of gas.
Where did that technology come from, man?
We actually, you're seeing it more and more. We're very fortunate here at the University of Michigan. We use a system called Catapult, which has a heart rate monitor, a GPS locator, an accelerometer. We get a variable amount of data for each practice, each workout, so that we can properly gauge, you know, what we used to call coach's intuition. We can put number values on it.
Hey, man, I'm way off my my list of stuff I want to talk to you about, and the listeners can just talk amongst themselves for a second. So, Coach, when you got into that, what surprised you? I mean, obviously, if we're, you know, running a 3v2 or something at the beginning of practice to set the tone of the pace and get everybody's mm-hmm. heart rate up and kind of get the energy going, which, you know, I think a lot of coaches have gone to that philosophy, not all. But even if they come back and work on the parts of the whole or, you know, revert back into what we affectionately call on our site, you know, the old Massera model, kind of an hour of fundamentals, whatever that means. I mean, it could mean station mm-hmm. work. It could mean footwork. In that other podcast you talked about when you were in college, skipping rope and doing ladders. Mm-hmm. All those kind of things, you know, shooting, maybe even some scout. And then but in that hour, you know, the second hour of practice generally sped up, you know, and one of the observations on the site is now we're seeing coaches really integrate, you know, it kind of started with Daly at Tufts, actually. You know, he had those engineers that couldn't attend practice, mm-hmm. you know, from like 4 to 5, you know, and so he had to plan his 10v10 around when he had his full roster there with the engineering labs. And, you know, then people kind of caught on to the, you know, balls to the wall transition and all that kind of stuff. But I am really, really curious what kinds of drills, and maybe it's an unfair question with off the top of your head. And just tell me, let's do the next question. I'm good at being told no. I'm just really, really curious. When you got into that data, what surprised you? Or maybe there weren't surprises. Were there drills that were actually more taxing than you expected and vice versa?
Yeah, I do. You know, I think what we got into it and we said a broad number. The reality is we don't have similar athletes playing similar positions. So when we got into it, we had to go ahead and look at it as position specific, and we also had to go into it, look at it drill specific. You know, as we go ahead and we're very similar in terms of we build our practices up. We're a part of the whole. We like to start off. Yes, we want to get after, get a tempo drill going, some competition early in our practice, but then make sure we're doing that fundamental breakdown, both sides of the ball, you know, small part drills, parts of the whole theme before we go ahead and build up to the ultimate crescendo, which is, you know, either it's a playing or full fielding, riding and clearing, things of that nature. So, what we found was there were certain drills that we felt were, oh, this is a quick one. It's going to be easy on the guys and that just gets in touches. And then we looked at the data and said, wow, that's actually relatively taxing. We can't put that on the Thursdays and things of that nature where we're trying to scale back to preserve our legs. We need to bump that to a Tuesday, which is more of a high intensity, up and down style of practice. So it really just takes the drills and puts them into our days a little bit easier. So when we're trying to get more up tempo, upfield, get up and down earlier in the week, we can put those higher load drills in.
So is there a drill that surprised you, Coach?
You know, not really. Not really. I would say, you know, we have a variety of drills that go off and try to do the same thing. We have, you know, we take the drills that have been so successful for so many people for so many years and add our own little tweaks to everything. But we put them in our drill bank. We have a running database of all of our drills. And we actually put the player load numbers in there for how much time we plan on doing it. So
yeah, you need to check out our site. According to Brody Merrill, I have 32 ways to run 3v2 on my site. I've only got 10 fingers and 10 toes, so I've not been able to confirm that.
I think we run 3v2, you know, 7 or 8 different ways. So it's what we found is one, the short quarter drills are more taxing because they're more physical, there's more contact, and there's more lateral movement change directions, which we found is actually more taxing than actually sprinting for multitude of yards. So we use those a little bit earlier in the week.
Man, that surprises me. You know, you would think if you're running 70-yard transition drills or something, that would be
it. The amount of force outputted in the amount of time.
God, I didn't study enough for this podcast, man. I'm feeling very, very stupid here all of a sudden.
You know, we're still in the learning phase as well. We're still in the data collection phase.
Right.
So it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun to kind of take an analytical approach to it.
So, Coach, are other D1 programs doing similar stuff? I would assume they are. I just haven't heard of it.
Yeah, a lot of other programs use this system in one way, in one capacity or another.
Yeah, crazy. How about as a as a metric for conditioning, like in fall?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have to make sure that we do track meters. So we have to we make sure we concentrate on how many meters we get for individuals as well.
How about weight room? Do you use it in the weight room too?
No, we do not use it in the weight room.
Okay.
No.
This is all new to me, man, and I'm fascinated by the science of it. You know, go ahead.
No, it's a fun system to kind of use. And again, a lot of it can be broken down into, I could have told you that just based on, that drill's hard based on my experience and having done it as a player. But sometimes, you know, there's some drills that you kind of sneak up on and you go, wow, that's harder than I thought. You know, especially as we start to get creative with the drill's purpose and how we execute it.
Man, great stuff. So we come out, we stretch. You set the tempo right away, or you go into a small parts? I'm assuming you're probably doing some of the shooting stuff as pre-practice, eh?
Yeah, we like to get our touches before stretch just to kind of dial in. We're a dial-in group. Like, okay, you know, sometimes stretching can get, you know, a little bit. We like to get our stretching focused. So if we can just get touches in an organized fashion for the first 5 minutes, get off the deck for the first 5 minutes as well, and then get ourselves into a stretching, it really kind of sets the tone, get our minds right for the mission ahead of us. We do post our practice plans so our guys know, what we're going to be doing in practice. We also have a section in our practice plan to know, that's the drill, but this is the purpose of the drill and why we're doing it, what we're looking to get out of it. So they're a little bit more prepared as they step on the field. So they know the mission, so we don't have to waste time going through all the finer points. It's a quick teach, and then our kids are dialed in right away to the purpose of the drill. And so
have you always published the practice plan, Coach?
Always publish it, yep.
I mean, in your career, coming up through all these programs.
No. You know, I've gone multiple different ways. I think it does depend on the team you have. I really feel like our guys are a group that are very analytical and like to know the reason why we do certain things. So if we can give them the reason, they are better equipped and more excited about the purpose.
Yeah. Allow me a broad generalization. Okay. We find the New York teams, the upstate teams, the Midwest teams, the coaches we've interviewed less likely to post. Long Island guys generally do not post. Maryland guys and down through the Mid-Atlantic corridor, have a tendency to post. And we have a lot of coaches that didn't post for 10 years, and now they're back. To your point on the analytics before actually posting, you got some of these guys are really, really analytical. I mean, guys like Bresci, guys like Pressler, they're actually in the practice plan, who changes into what color penny at what time. You know, I mean, that kind of minutia that they're sharing with the players. And, I don't know, man. I've gone back and forth myself personally. I like the rationale argument of the ebbs and flows of the game and the momentum shifts and the surprises being emulated in practice. But I think what's the evolution of college practices, at least we've seen it here, is they're accomplishing the same thing with the drills. They can go ahead and post it. The nature of the drills is changing that up.
Yeah, and we found that as well. And I've been a guy that's done it, you know, both ways, six different ways from Sunday.
Oh, yeah, there's no right, no wrong. It's just kind of interesting, you know, what the reasons are. Yeah,
yeah, and I you know, I think this year what we found, our kids just, they appreciate it more, and they're more in tune to practice. In previous years, it was like, I don't care what's on the practice plan. Let's just get out there. And so, you know, you can kind of, you know, in other years, we've seen guys go, okay, I can take this drill off, or I can really bang it in this drill. So, you know, you always fall into those dangers. But it is very dependent on the group you have.
See, I always thought that kind of rationale wasn't giving the kids the credit that they were due. Or in your case, the young men, the credits they would do. You know,
yeah,
and I heard you talk on other interviews about culture. I mean, if the culture is that, you know, we're going to get out and get it, right? And I think, now remember, in real life, this is my research area, right, on millennials and writing books and everything else. But, yeah, at the end of the day, I think, you know, in the old days, if you were questioned, why are we doing this drill, coaches saw it as a sign of insubordination.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think it's just a natural way that this the millennial generation functions. You know, I mean they're not going to buy in unless they know why, and why needs to be a pretty good explanation. You know, I mean it's got to make sense. And you know, I get coaches telling me, well, they don't need to know that, they don't need this, and you're going like, well, obviously you're doing it for a reason. Does it make you less of a leader if you share what that reason is? You know, I mean,
and
you know, I don't really get it. You know.
Exactly, and it's a very interesting point about leadership. It's just about, you know, because, you know, the teams are only, you know, these kids only have 4 years in order to make an impact on a program. We really try to transfer ownership to the leaders of the program. So if you're going to try to transfer ownership and get some internal leadership, well, then you really need to give them the whys and the purpose of everything. So, and I think that is a big part of the culture.
You know, it's kind of funny. When I wrote the Gen X book, I did a telephone interview with Bobby Bowden. And in my mind, Bobby Bowden was a relic. You know, I mean, I saw him as a very charismatic, but a figurehead guy, you know, not really involved in the minutia or the stuff. And I was asking him about the difference of the athletes, you know, over his long career. And he said, you know, 10 years, this was in 2004 or something, I wrote that book. Anyway. He said, I'll never forget it. He said, you know, it's interesting. 10 years ago, you said run through a wall of fire, and they ran through a wall of fire. Now you have to explain why the wall of fire, and this is really interesting. He said, now you need to understand, or you need to explain why the wall of fire is important to their individual growth as well as the team growth. And if you sell that why effectively, they'll run through the wall quicker, faster, higher than you could have ever imagined. The athletes being so much more athletic, if that's even fair to say. But it was interesting to me that he chose the sequence of, it's not just to make the team better, it's to make you better as an individual player.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he included in that rationale. And, you know, I walked away from that 15 or 20 minute telephone interview thinking, man, this guy's no relic. He really gets it. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, he knows how to communicate with this generation. And that was really, really interesting.
Absolutely.
Okay, so now let's say we got practice going a little bit. We've taken a stretch. Now you're going to focus on the small parts. Is that broken down by position mostly, Coach?
So we go into – well, we got to get the juices going. So we like to compete a little bit right away, you know, for different drills. We certainly have competition drills that we'd like to choose from, where they be – you know, I have an assistant coach from Duke, and he likes to do that tight 3v2 kind of contact drills, and we like to do some other things to kind of get going. Some days we'll just throw the ball out and say, okay, game to one, let's go. Okay? So it gets the guys juiced up early in practice. But then we go into a development phase. We call it individual development. We split up by position, defense one side, offense the other side. So, you know, and then within that grouping, we focus defensively on our individual footwork, our individual hand placement, things around the cage. We will build up to a little bit more team concepts about flowing and moving together offensively. That's when we hit a good amount of technical stick work, technique dodging, scoring through the various levels, shooting through the various levels, so that we're dialing in and honing in the skills so that we're ready to take on the next phase of practice more effectively and fundamentally. After that, we kind of mix in, we'll go to a small parts. What is the theme of the day? You know, what are we looking to cover? What are we looking to execute? What are we looking to hone in? So we want to break it down into a little bit more of, you know, for some days it's about our breakdowns and approaches or our quick dodges. So we'll do individual kind of small one-on-ones in tight areas or off of pass one-on-ones or, you know, a 2v1 ground ball that'll evolve into a 2v2, things like that. So we're getting that approach and attacking approaches. You know, it's so much of our game is, you know, yes, we build slide recovery packages. Yes, we build offensive schemes, X's and O's. But eventually, a lot of those things do break down, and it will rely on that one-on-one matchup. So we hone in on proper technique on both sides in order to be more effective, excuse me, on winning that matchup. And how do we do it and where do we do it is all kind of broken down for the better part of the week based on what we need to get better at or what our opponents are pretty good at. You know, so then we kind of evolve. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, you know, it's kind of funny. Years ago, I did a podcast with Lars Tiffany, and it's right about the time, like 8 or 9 years ago, Coach, when, you know, back in my era, you know, when you wanted to redirect the ball strong to weak, you know, it always went through X. Mm-hmm. And then I think, you know, the Loyola team, and actually Charlie Toomey gave a lot of that credit to Kyle Hanna when he was at Goucher. They started to redirect the ball topside because they didn't think they had the personnel behind, you know, to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were talking about, you know, these philosophical dialogues about is it more effective and what are the scenarios when you want to redirect the ball to the other side of the field behind or up top and all that kind of stuff. And there's like silence on the phone for like 8 seconds, which is like 30 years, you know, in a podcast. But then again, man, you know, I mean, it's all good dialogue philosophically, but at the end of the day, nothing happens till somebody beats somebody anyway.
Exactly.
You know? And, yeah, I think that's one of the things that more mature coaches understand more than younger coaches do, that at the end of the day, players got to make plays.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Now, we can build, you know, we really believe that effective defenses can slide, recover, you know, twice, three times. Sometimes they're going to break down. So we got to be able to make sure we are prepared to win a matchup on both sides, offense or defense, when there's no support.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by the verbiage you used. It wasn't technical dodges. You're working on the individual techniques on the dodges?
Yeah, technique, footwork, you know, how to manipulate a slide guy, how to use your explosion, not just a straight line dodger, but also change the angle on which you're dodging during a dodge. Bouncing away, rollbacks, just proper footwork in order to get that to clean it up and make us more efficient through our dodging. Coach Terry does an unbelievable job with our guys kind of breaking it down in phases and phases and phases. So they are, by the time we're ready to put it together, they have the complete catalog of good footwork.
So you start that on a skeleton basis, Coach, and then you start to integrate defenders on those dodges and turn it into a 1v1 or, like you said, a 2v1 ground ball into a 2v2 or whatever it turns out to be?
Yeah, our small part segments is a very broad collection of drills. You know, we do exactly that. We separate it from just development phase, and then we'll bring in those action defenders and put ourselves in different positions to go, okay, we've had our initial dodge. Let's bring it down to the second dodge part of a one-on-one, or the re-dodge, as a lot of people call it. Or, you know, we've put ourselves on goal line extended. Now, how do we get away from a hold? Do things off of contact, so we can work on that second phase of a lot of things.
So in your smalls part stuff, maybe an unfair question, what percentage of all that is skeleton?
The small parts is never skeleton. Small parts, so we go development never and skeleton. Then small
okay.
parts. Yeah.
So development would be skeleton in your verbiage.
Yeah, we'll do about 15 to 20 minutes of development from a positional standpoint a day, and then we'll transition to, you know, depending on the day of the week, then we'll push into, a couple small part drills in order to get, so it's more like it's probably another 20-minute segment that we're focusing just on our small parts.
Anything new there, Coach, that maybe an assistant, I mean, it seems so often one of the great benefits of being on different staffs or bringing guys in like you have on your staff, is the new ideas and stuff that come with it. Is there something you're doing now that you hadn't done in the past in terms of the development or the small parts that you think has helped you tremendously, Coach?
You know what?
Or it's just kind of like you got to get the lunchbox and go to work.
Yeah, we kind of get the lunchbox and go to work. We tweak everything. You know, we're not reinventing the wheel over here. You know, we really focus on what are some of the best minds doing and how can we make it appropriate for us. So we take everything of kind of, you know, your simple small 4v4, you know, and we kind of go and, okay, what do we need to work on and how do we break it down in a 4v4 concept so that our guys can just work on that aspect. You know, like we talked about the one-on-one, let's just do a one-on-one, but let's do it like, you know, you didn't win the initial dodge, you know, or something of that nature. So it's really kind of in, you know, both of my assistant coaches, all three of my assistant coaches have education backgrounds. And so when you look at it and they go, okay, we're very much believing in that part whole method that most good educators and good teachers are taught how to teach. So why don't we just apply that to our lacrosse knowledge? And so that's kind of what we do.
Well, and I can see that coming from Duke. I think if you asked Danowski, are you a coach or a teacher, he would tell you he's a teacher.
And that's kind of my background as well. I have a master's degree in education, so that's where I learned how to teach. And you know, you teach, whether you're teaching social studies or you're teaching lacrosse, you know, you do it a certain way.
For sure. All right, so we come out of that kind of stuff. Where are we going to go now with practice, Coach?
I think, you know,
we're about a half hour in, or maybe 40 minutes in, roughly.
Yeah, we're probably about 40 to 45 minutes in. We look to kind of where do we need to go from here. Well, a lot of the times we will transition into some full field, kind of get the legs back up and going, right, start to expand a little bit more, whether you'd be traditional, you know, 3v4 to 4v3s to 5v4s, or, you know, more of the actualities, like we just played a 3-on-3, we got to get back in the hole, those split second 6v5s to a 6v6. So we train our guys to play a little offense. What happens next? Maybe it's a turnover or whatnot. Let's get back in the hole. But we take the guy who's shot, run him around the crease, run him out, and then the 2 minutes go back. So you have a 6-on-5 coming down, and then we start to work on our slow break offense, you know, things of that nature. How do we go ahead and attack that, recognizing it as a defense, while also what's the proper approach and how do we attack it as an offense? Excuse me.
Yeah, I get it. So how long is that, you're calling it full field, but really there's a lot of transition built into that too, right?
Yeah, there's a lot. This is our transition segments. You know, we call this transition time.
Okay.
And these are really like, you know, especially during season, this is like a Tuesday where we need to ramp up kind of our player load.
Yeah.
You know, and then we will transition into some 6-on-6. We want to make sure that we're getting our X's and O's dialed in now. You know, we've kind of built up. So let's put it all together in a half field where we're either prepping for a team in a scout segment or doing it 1v1 so that we're competing and banging heads a little bit.
So, Coach, tell me a little bit about how that might work in a 6v6, one or two segments that you want to focus on. Are you saying like, okay, we want to, you know, work on a 1v1, you know, off a pass, that guy can't really feed until he drives and goes to the cage. Is that kind of what you're describing in terms of what individual, areas or priorities you might put in the, cause you're just not playing 6v6. I mean,
well, this is the time, this time as we start to evolve through practice, this is really our 6v6 time, our organization time. So we've cleared it. We've done our transition. Okay, now it's time to settle it in. Okay, let's win a matchup. Let's win the possession and try to get ourselves organized as quickly as possible. A lot of this will be two half fields, so we'll split up and try to bring, you know, coaches on both sides and just run regular offense. Put a time on it, like a shot clock, so that we're always monitoring how efficient we're going to be in each segment. Plus now we're in the shot clock era, so how do we play with the shot clock? Really hone in a lot of game plans, get ourselves organized. And again, on like a day like a Tuesday, This could be a 10-minute segment. On a day like a Wednesday or a Thursday, it's probably more a 15, 20-minute segment. So now we're kind of ironing out and sharpening the knife of all of our game plans, and so we're more prepared when we are playing 6-on-6 on Saturdays.
All right, where do we go from there, Coach?
Well, then we want to put it all together, riding and clearing. One of the things that we really kind of look for as we've gone from transition to half field, everything needs to end in some sort of ride or a clear so that we're clearing the ball effectively. The new rules with the clearing clock is something that we're very interested in. How do we get the ball over midline in before that 20 seconds? So that's something that we've focused on throughout the practice, but also now let's hone it in and play a scramble style of scrimmage on a Tuesday where you just blow the whistle, roll the ball out. Kind of old school, but still very effective. It gets the guys' kind of heart rates up, moving up and down, playing in the gray, just the uncertainty of something happened, let's react. And then we can also hone in, how do we ride, how do we clear?
Yeah, I'm looking at the clearing stats slightly above the NCAA average, right? 858 for last year.
Yeah, and I think that's something that we really could have been better at, specifically in big games. I think there we let some things go by not being as organized as possible, but also not being able to handle a lot of the unsettledness of the quick turnovers, things of that nature, taking advantage of that. So we work a lot on the oh my god, what just happened? You know, kind of aspect of lacrosse. You know, I think that's something that we really try to drone in, and it starts in small parts, it starts in transitions, it starts a lot of different ways, and it goes on a day-to-day option. It's just, what just happened? Okay, let's adjust to it and fix it, you know, and instead of getting the deer in headlights look, let's plan for the unplanned.
Do you really think it's going to change the dynamics of what we on our site we call static clears or setup clears, Coach?
I do.
At the D1 level?
Yeah, I do. I think you're going to see a lot more clearing clock violations, press rides, things of that nature. So we're trying to see how we can combat that.
What was your experience this fall?
Is it
something that's in the players' heads? Is it something that wasn't a big deal to them? Kind of the prevailing comments that I'm getting from coaches that we interview are more in the camp that the coaches were more concerned about it than the players were. Is that now? There's programs. I mean, obviously, it's going to have a big effect on Denver, right? Where it is going to have a huge effect. But by and large, what's your overall reaction to that? From how many scrimmages did you do this fall, Coach? I know you did a couple, right?
Yeah, we did two. We played Denver and we played BU. It was two different games for sure. I think our kids are just playing, but we give, you know, we're hoping to get those reads a little bit earlier. We've tweaked the way we have cleared in the past. So, we're seeing how it evolves. And again, I think this has been, this has been something that has been an experimental fall for a lot of different things. So we're still kind of toying with it. You know, I think one of the things that we're going to be really focused on is our opening scrimmages in February will be, okay, how are they doing it to us? How do we combat it a little bit more? So, you know, February, early March is really what you're going to see teams come out and the common themes.
Well, and then, you know, again, we can talk philosophy till we're green in the face. A lot of it boils down to personnel as well.
Yeah, and that's my big belief. You know, it does depend who we're playing down there, who's got it, you know, who's got the ball, how are we going to combat that? So, where do we put our kids in position to be the most successful?
I mean, some guys are faster. Some guys have better field acumen. You know, I mean.
Absolutely.
An interesting balance to see how that goes. So you wrap up the practice with 10v10s with the rides and the clears, Coach?
We do that with rides and clears, full field, up and down. Sometimes we just play. We try to be more of a that area, be more of an up-tempo, full field avenue, and then we'll finish with man up, man down. You know, we've toyed around in various points of practice with implementing man up, man down in, you know, much like a game. You know, you have, you know, 5 minutes into the second quarter. Oh, now you have a penalty. All right, well, let's do a quick man down there. So we toy around with that.
Yeah, Coach, I'm really curious because this is a question we get on the site all the time. You know, I think, you know, it's funny. I'll finish a podcast, you know, and I'm married 42 years to the greatest hippie lacrosse chick coach's wife of all time, okay? And so she'll come home tonight and she'll say, hey, man, how'd it go? And I'm going, and I, you know, I'm always like melancholy again. And she's going, how was the podcast? I'm going, man, the guy was great. And she's going, well, you don't seem too happy. I'm going, well, he's talking about all this stuff that I should have thought about 10 years ago. Where have I been? You know, I mean, that's what happens to me after the, you know, I mean, shoot, after 160 hours on the air and a lot of times, you know, 20 or 30 minutes off the air. I mean, I've probably had 2 hours of, or 200 hours of personal training, you know, in the last 10 years. And I like to think I've improved, but I'm also aware of how far my delta is yet to go before I'm any good, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you know, we've got coaches like Petros practicing timeout once, or excuse me, halftime once a week, you know, trying to keep his teams from coming out flat, you know, in the third quarter. They actually take 10 minutes. They take their helmets off. Coaches stay in the field. Players go in. They run back out. They go to the bathroom, get a drink. They run back out. Boom, they're right into a – right into a 10v10 with a pretty good competition element to it, you know. And then, well, in, you know, like 7 or 8 years ago, we started here, coaches actually practicing timeouts, you know, and it was amazing. It didn't seem to affect the players as much as it affected the coaches. You know, the coaches are going, I really learned that we're over-communicating in our timeouts. You know, we really can stress one or two points. You know, so the coaches are getting together saying, okay, here's five things we probably need to talk about. You know, how do we boil this down to one message, you know, or two message, even if it's a defensive coach? I mean, it's interesting, you know, the D1 guys have broken it down into this minutia. This is a long way to go to get to my question. My question is, if you've tried integrating the man-up, man-downs into the course of the practice, and now you're going back to a dedicated segment at the end, what was your thought process on that, Coach? What did you think wasn't being fulfilled that you can do so much better going back to a more traditional way of running your man up, man down in practice?
I think
again,
when
you're right or wrong, I'm just really curious to hear what your thoughts are.
I think it's just, you know, sometimes just throw them a curveball. Just, you know, there might be a point during practice where you might just call a penalty and say, flag down, you know, you got a 60 minute or a 60 second penalty here. You got to get a stop or you got to score. Let's go. So, you know, it puts that same kind of concept that we're doing in a game and say, okay, change focus, okay, let's not do transition, let's not do 6-on-6, focus now on, boom, now we have this opportunity, let's take advantage of that. So when you do it at the end, you feel like time, right, when it's kind of towards the tail end of practice, you can get more organized in that nature, teach a little bit more of the concepts that you're trying to execute. When you do it in the middle of practice, it's more about, okay, execute. So it's all about, you know, during the week, we'll change it up a little bit more, to say we're going to do it here or we're going to do it there. So, you know, as long as we're leading with that organizational aspect, we can throw in the quick ones throughout practice on a day-to-day basis.
Well, and it's interesting to me, man, that you're really the first coach that I've talked to that says there's a benefit to us by doing it both ways.
Yeah, there's a thousand ways to skin this cat. One thing I recognize.
That's the reason I keep saying no right or no wrong. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
there's
yeah,
no wrong.
It's
believe me.
Yeah.
What we do is we take the ideas of a lot of people who are a lot smarter than I am and make them applicable to what we're trying to do or tweak them along the way. So, you know, we're not reinventing the wheel over here. We're not reinventing the wheel.
I think you're pretty smart. What's the kid's favorite drill, Coach?
Oh, that's a really good question. Good question. You know, we ask them all the time. I think it's obviously scrimmaging, but I think when you look at, you know, they like that tight quarters 3v2. They really like that one. We brought that in this year, and that's been a fan favorite.
Yeah, on the website, we call those, for lack of a better description, we call them crunch drills, just because we're crunching the field, so to speak, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah, I like that. Good terminology, yeah.
Well, and then, you know, we've probably got 8 different or 10 different or 12 different crunch drills on the site, you know, and then J.B. Clark has actually taken that to a different level where on a clearing drill they've got 3 different segments of the field,
mm-hmm.
and there's like a crunch in each segment,
You know, he runs his clears hash mark to hash mark. Not all the time, you know, but I mean,
as
a way of crunching the clear for the same philosophy that you would have, you know, crunching a 3v2 and trying to make the recognition in the passes so much faster. So when you do the tight spaces, your terminology, I'm sure you've got two or three ways you set that up, but what's the player's favorite way that you set that up?
We put it in the women's arc on our field, put the cage in the women's arc. And we play within the cone, in the 8 meter cone. And so we roll it out. We give the offense a quick advantage. We roll it out, so everybody kind of lines up on the crease. Offensive team or the three has their back foot on the crease line, the women's crease. The defensive team has their front foot on the crease line. Roll the ball out. It's an old Duke drill. They've been doing it for years.
Yeah, last time I talked to Danowski, he was actually moving away from some of the crunch stuff, which was kind of interesting. He thought that it hurt. I don't want to put words in his mouth, you know, and I'm very, very sensitive about that. The impression I got was that, you know, the spacing and the wide open vision was a higher priority than some, and that really kind of surprised me. You know, I don't know when the last time I interviewed him, probably a year ago or so, but that was kind of interesting. Yeah, we run that with cones right up in the middle of the crease and two sides, like a right and a left side.
Sure.
I got that from Bates, and then we toggle it, left side, right side, left side, right side. And I'm trying to think, somebody I interviewed, when they run it in the women's arc, they called it the cone of silence drill.
that's what it is, yeah. we've heard that before, yeah.
Well, Coach, man, I just wish you absolutely the best. Let me ask you a couple of closing questions here, man. When you get these players in, let me ask you a cultural question first.
Sure.
Obviously, huge shift in the culture. Bringing somebody like you in versus the way, and, you know, I interviewed John Paul, and we talked about the 10-man ride when they were winning the MCLA and all that kind of stuff in the years past. But how tough was it getting the players that you had not recruited or didn't come there because of you on board? Because obviously your style is a lot different, and now you've added some coaches that have actually changed it up, you know, again. Was that an uphill battle, or did it go easier than you thought, or what surprised you about that whole process?
No, I wouldn't call it an uphill battle. I think what John Paul has been able to do is take that transition from club to varsity was very impressive, what he was able to do here. You know, the amount of time, energy, and the recruiting that has been put into place really made my transition that much easier. They just got a hungry group who was, you know, very excited coming in, and we had leaders. We had leaders. John Paul recruited guys who could be very reliable as leaders, too. So when we came in and we started to change some things, you know, change is always very, very hard. But the guy's willingness to buy in made our transition that much easier. And it has continued to kind of filter down through the ranks. So, you know, culturally we're changing, we're evolving every single day. And again, culture is really it's about the group in the locker room and how do you attack and how do you get the most out of each and one of them every single year. So cultures evolve every year, but there's certainly consistencies there, and I've been very fortunate to have a foundation that was already set in place when I took the position.
You know, Coach, I've coached at the high school varsity level, coached the travel team, the one that won the Dick's National Championship, a team from Georgia, believe it or not. A couple of those guys are in the MLL now. And then my MCLA experience at Auburn. I think the last 10 years it's been harder and harder to identify or maybe train or evolve leaders out of this generation. Would you agree or disagree with that comment?
I disagree. I think there's leadership qualities in everybody. What we do is we try to start young to identify and then empower so they feel like it's a growth process. So we don't just find a senior and say, okay, you're the guy now. I don't think that's very fair. I think you have to help them along the way and build the bridge so that they're ready to cross it. So it's an evolution.
Give me an example of how you empower or build that bridge, because, man, I really struggle with that.
Well, I think, you know, again, there's a thousand.
And they're good young men, and they're good players. Okay.
They're great kids. I think you find your hardworking guys, and you really kind of, you know, we do a leadership council. We don't just have captains. We do leadership council, you know, so that we have, sure, we have our captains group, our core group, and then we ask, we really need to get a good pulse for the whole group. You know, so we have guys from each class represented that we meet every other week and we discuss how our team is and how we can get better. And you really kind of, and you hopefully you get more input from the younger guys. It's not just the seniors, because they could be a very loud voice. But if you can empower those freshmen to say, okay, this is what's going on with the freshman class, because they're just in a different world. So, it's helpful to hear about that and the struggles and the positivities and everything that they're going through is different than what a senior's going through right now. So, we try to build that as well.
Man, I love that idea. I love that idea.
Yeah, we also
kind of...
Did it
take a while for those meetings to evolve into being something smooth? Was a little awkward at first?
There's, you know, we're still evolving. You know, I don't think anything is perfect. We're learning. You know, we give team books. We encourage guys to read various leadership books along the way. So it's been it's fun to hear their take on what makes good leaders and things of that nature. So, you know,
man, there's so many great books out there right now too, isn't there? I mean, there's just all kinds of good stuff.
Some of these guys, they look at me like I got seven heads. You want me to read a book? You know, it's like, do they have a movie on this? I've been asked. You know, can I get it from Audible? You know, I think that's other ones. But no, I make them read it and annotate it.
That's like us in the old days, right, Coach? We wanted to know where the cliff notes were. Now they want to know, is there a video wrap-up? Can I see this on YouTube?
Exactly.
Okay, you know, show me the Snapchat version, you know?
Exactly.
I mean, really, that's really funny. Really funny. Very cool, man. Hey, we talked a little bit off the air. Give me a rundown on what you're doing up there for, and incidentally, on the website, we are just huge, huge proponents of, you know, and I'm a travel team coach. Actually, I just bought a lacrosse company that's got three leagues and travel teams and blah, blah, blah. But I'm not sure travel teams are the answer for being recruited. You know, I think that may surprise people when they hear me say that. I really think... you know, if you've got it, you know, a couple of places in mind, going on the campus, getting a feel for the campus, getting a feel for the staff is well worth the money. And if you can't do two travel teams or summer and fall travel teams, you know, get out of one of those and work on your game and go to, you know, take the money and go to two campuses or three campuses and actually see the difference in the coaching staffs, the difference in the academic priorities. Obviously at Michigan you got tremendous academic school, which isn't to sell short, you know, Maryland, Fairfield, Penn State, Siena, blah blah blah. But talk to me about the recruiting camps and the stuff you're doing up there, and where our listeners may go to get some of that information.
Well, sure. We, all of our information will be on our school website, mgoblue.com.
Okay.
And then you can see, nothing's posted yet, but we will be posting in the next couple of weeks about one of the things that we really believe in and are hoping to revive are the positional camps, the instructional-based camps where kids can come, experience the dorm life and be a part of it, but also learn lacrosse, where we're doing not just rolling the ball out and play, but making sure that they can get instruction from our staff, our players, and people that we bring in. It's one of my passions. I love doing it. We have an amazing instructional-based program that we try to push off starting in July or the middle of July, July 14th to, I believe, the 17th. And then we have some what we're calling Division I experience camps towards the tail end of that week, where we bring guys in and take them through really how we build a practice plan, how we approach each and every day, film sessions, scouting reports, everything in that nature to give guys the idea of what Division I lacrosse is really about. It's not just, you know, showing up and playing a couple games here or there. It's a lot of work that goes into the build-up into a Saturday contest. So we're pretty excited. We're we're working out the kinks on that one and the schedules, but we're really excited about what it's evolving to.
I mean, you just got amazing facilities up there now, huh?
We do. We really do. We've been in here for about 6 months now, and it's a game changer for our guys. We have a home. It's beautiful. The resources here at the University of Michigan are second to none, and we're just excited to be a part of it.
How do you look in navy blue, man? Is that a good color on you?
I look fantastic, yeah. I feel like I've really...
Oh, they don't even call it... I'm sorry. I've just made the biggest blasphemy of the world, didn't I? It's made...
Navy blue. Navy
blue. What was
blue.
I thinking? Okay. Last Coach Mike is a dumbass. Everybody, write your emails now. It's good. Last Coach Mike is a dumbass. It's maize and blue.
Yeah, you got to be careful there.
Well, I went to Worthington High School in Columbus, so yeah, the maize and blue were never on my radar when I was growing up. But,
Yeah,
I get it now.
Last Garland Gray in that next.
Well, yeah, and that's another whole story, isn't it? God, I think back of how stupid I was as a teenager. You know, they had 3.2% beer back in those days in Ohio, you know, so if you were 18, you could drink the watered-down beer. We'd go to Ohio State and think we were so cool. And actually, we were just being idiots, right? Man. Hey, Coach, I have so enjoyed staying aligned with me here. I'm going to sign off. But
sure.
I got 4 pages of notes here, and I'm so intrigued with 2 things from the podcast. The 2 big takeaways for me are, again, you know, there's so many ways to skin a cat. And I say this very, very respectfully, you know, your practice plan and schematics are relatively traditional, aren't they? But yet, you know, from what I've heard, the kids just love playing for you, and you're a great communicator, and, you know, now you're really starting to put together a great staff. So the one takeaway is there's a lot of ways to do this, and obviously you're well on your way to making this pro. I mean, your conference is just so tough. Oh my God!
It's the best
the
in the country by far, I think, believe. So we're excited to compete in it.
Oh yeah, and the you know, the second thing is the leadership council, man. I just I get it all the time, you know, from coaches. Should I pick captain? Should I let the team pick captain? I mean, high school coaches, you know, that are on
mm-hmm.
our site. And, you know, I think for me, the greatest experience in the world would be, you know, in a tight game where you call a timeout or the other coach calls a timeout and the kids all come in and they say, Coach, go sit on the bench. We got this.
Yeah,
that's my dream of heaven, you know, when the players
coaching.
Say...
Yeah, we feel like the best teams really do coach themselves. I think, you know.
Well, that's my version. That's my, I mean, everybody, culture is such a big word, but really when I use the word culture, that's what I'm talking about. The expectations and the accountability to teammates. You know, I think the individual charismatic leadership is no longer effective with this group of people. I think great coaches build great cultures. Some of them it's easier because they walk into a great tradition and it's established to a degree. Some of them have to come in and build it, and then you may get you know, personnel that either blend in or obviously, occasionally we get players that don't blend in. But those were the huge things that I took away. I just really, really thrilled that I had a chance to meet you, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, stay on the line with me here 1 second. This is Lax Coach Mike, laxcoachmike.com. Keep your eye on this U of M program, man. Maize and blue, maize and blue. They are outrageously on their way to doing great things, and now you understand why with this coach at the helm. Remember, man, you got a tremendous, tremendous responsibility, influencing the lives, opportunity to influence the lives of these young people. Take it seriously every day. Flat Coach Mike, till next time, God bless everybody.